It's a song. In Japanese, it's a wasan, which it's a song that is common people would sing. So he wrote this for us, not for the intellectuals or the great. That's not. It's for us to appreciate. We common people.
So is there like a tune traditionally?
No. I don't think so. I don't think there was a tune.
But it has sort of the rhythm of Japanese prosody. I'll bring the Japanese next year.
I've got the Japanese here. But anyway, yeah, I'll
chant it the way they would.
Next class I'll talk a little bit about that, the rhythm of it. Yeah. So originally I had planned I would do like four talks on Hakuin Zenji, the person who wrote this. And talk a bit about his life, because he had a very interesting life, and also the influence that his poetry and his particularly his art has had on Japanese culture and on the Zen tradition. He was quite well known as a Zen artist, painter, and his poetry was fairly well known, but not as much as his art. But since we have a guest coming to lead us in various arts and things in the next, after 2 weeks, so I'm just going to talk about the Song of Zazen. And then later on, I'll pick up Hakuin again and talk about his art, maybe bring in some slides and things like that. It's quite wonderful. So, Hakuin Zenji, who the heck is this guy? Well, unlike many of the other Zen teachers, Zen ancestors that we talk about, Hakuin was not a Soto Zen priest. He was a priest in the Rinzai tradition, the tradition that emphasizes the use of koans in Zazen practice. You know, the sound of one hand is one famous koan that Hakuin Zenji himself created. But mu, and what was your face before your grandparents were born, and all those kind of questions are all koans. So Hakuin, Eikaku, was born in 1686. So about 450 years roughly after Dogen. So Zen is very well established, and in fact, it, like everything, had been in decline for a while. And Hakuin is famous as the great reviver of the Rinzai tradition in Japan. He is the one who revitalized it, took it out of a kind of scholarly, academic practice, which it had kind of fallen into, and really enlivened it again. From its long period of stagnation. Hakuin is the person who revived or revitalized the koan practice in Japan. And yet, at the same time, he also acknowledged the power of other practices. He encouraged study, he encouraged chanting, Pure Land practice, he was very familiar with. And he was very devoted to the Lotus Sutra, which generally is connected with, well, with all the Buddhist traditions, but particularly with another branch known as the Nichiren tradition in Japan. So although he's famous for being very critical of people who don't practice, he recognized the value of practice in general. He taught both men and women, monastics and commoners, young and old. No one was turned away from his relatively small temple. And he was famous for being a very strict teacher who insisted on unrelenting practice and was bitterly critical, particularly of monastics, those people who had ordained as monks and nuns, who did not devote themselves to practice, scathingly critical, kind of like the Irish can, you know, really be throw a curse and be critical of somebody. He was like that. I'm going to bring some in to read because they're quite funny actually when you read them. And yet at the same time, he was also very generous, with a very powerful sense of humor that we'll look at a little bit later, especially in his art. His art is very humorous. His self-portraits are a hoot. Okay. So just to give you a sense of the humor of Hakuin, here's one story from a collection, a recent collection that's being published called The Hidden Lamp, a collection of Zen stories with commentaries by contemporary women Zen teachers, including Kate is in there too. So here's the story of Hakuin from that collection. An old woman went to hear Master Hakuin give a lecture. He said, "Your mind is the pure land, and your body is Amida Buddha. When Amida Buddha appears, mountains, rivers, forests, and fields all radiate a great light. If you want to understand, look into your own heart." I suspect he was talking to probably a group, but maybe particularly this one old woman, because she is a Pure Land practitioner. And Pure Land is a form of practice in the Buddhist tradition of chanting, particularly the name or the of Amida, Amitabha Buddha. Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. And then Chinese Amidofu, I think. Amidofu, Amidofu. So we're just repeating this over and over and offering, calling upon Amida for help, for assistance. So far okay? So the old woman, pondering Hakuin's words day and night, waking and sleeping. And then, one day, as she was washing a pot after breakfast, a great light flashed through her mind. She dropped the pot and ran to tell Hakuin. "Amida Buddha filled my whole body. Mountains, rivers, forests, and fields are all shining with light. How wonderful!" She danced for joy. "What are you talking about?" Hakuin asked. "Does the light shine out of your asshole?" Small as she was, she gave him a big push, knocking him over, saying, "I can see you're not enlightened yet." And they both burst out laughing. So the stories of Hakuin are often like this. And another famous one, which I'll bring in a little bit later, is of a young, a teenage woman, I think she's like 16 or something, who was quite famous for outsmarting Hakuin over and over again. She was one of his students. We'll talk about her a little bit later, next week, I think. So let's now look at the Song of Zazen here. It's quite a very moving poem. As people said earlier, you know, it kind of brings together so many of the key teachings of the Buddhist tradition, and does so in a way that's quite accessible. I was reading through part of the Japanese, and even without resorting to my usual pile of dictionaries, I could make out most of it. So at the very beginning, Hakuin sets forth the most fundamental view of Zen, that all beings by nature are Buddha. The Japanese word here for beings is shujo, which means literally something like beings living in samsara, beings living in this world of change and discontent. And Buddha, of course, is one who is awake to her totality that includes and goes beyond everyday views of this world. And there are many expressions used in the Zen tradition to try and express this idea of Buddha. So it's not really referring to the historical Buddha, right? So things like true self, Buddha nature, emptiness, the person of true rank, etc. Those are just a few expressions that we'll find in the Zen literature. Hakuin tells us here that Buddha is not something that exists apart from us, apart from you. That our very nature, our very source, is this Buddha or this Buddha nature. I think most of us find this pretty hard to accept. We see all too clearly our flaws, our brokenness, our ignorance, and struggles with all the hindrances that arise. Buddha or Buddha nature seems more likely to exist outside, certainly outside of ourselves, a distant place or state to aspire to perhaps, but outside. But then Hakuin continues with a simile. Like water and ice, without water, there can be no ice. Apart from beings like us, no Buddha nature. And I find this simile or this symbolism really quite striking, quite moving. Water responds to any shape. It flows everywhere. And it nurtures. We could say, in one sense, water is the essence of the myriad forms of life. Ice is relatively unmoving. It's difficult to alter its shape. It's cold and hard, fixed, more or less. I know ice does flow, but generally we think of it as fixed. Just like us, somehow. I mean, if you kind of feel like fixed. And yet, when we warm ice, it becomes water. And it's not that ice is bad or unnecessary or ice, we need to get rid of ice. We're all aware, you know, of course, of the preciousness of our ice fields and glaciers, etc. But to stretch this simile a little further, if ice forgets that it also embodies the flowing, nurturing aspects of water, then it's trapped in just being ice. If we are blind to our Buddha nature, we're trapped, ruled by the rigid stories told to us and the stories we tell ourselves. We're trapped by those stories. We're ignorant of our flowing nature that we share with all beings. And there's one more aspect I'd like to tack on to the simile. Ice needs to be heated to become water. We need practice to realize that we are more than the stories that we tell ourselves. It's like, I think, give another simile. It's like those gifted with certain innate talents. Unless they are cultivated and deepened, the talents will just remain latent or only partially ever get expressed. Right? This simile is actually, I discovered, kind of old in the Buddhist tradition. Hakuin Zenji didn't invent it. Another Japanese Rinzai monk I came across, Basui, in the 14th century, used the same simile in his talks in a work collected in English called Mud and Water. And he wrote, "There is no ice or snow apart from water. Buddhahood of ordinary people can be likened to snow and ice melting and becoming water. From the beginning, nothing has ever been lost." perhaps in our confusion and struggles, we can take some comfort in this. From the beginning, nothing has been lost. How sad that people ignore the near and search for truth afar. Like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst, like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor. Most of us, or at least many of us, at some point during this lifetime, begin a search or a pilgrimage to find out the truth of this life, the life right now. And for some reason, we set down the many distractions offered to us, and to a greater or lesser extent, put our time and energy into this question, even if we cannot clearly articulate it. And naturally, we start looking around for an answer. What is this life about? And sometimes we travel great distances, sampling one spiritual tradition after another, reading one book after another. And personally, I think this is unavoidable for most of us. It's very seldom that we immediately fall into the perfect place, find the perfect person, the perfect book that answers our questions to our satisfaction. But at some point, we must settle down and do the hard, painful work of deeply investigating and opening to who we are. The path we take to do this difficult work varies from person to person, depending on their personality, depending on their conditioning, depending on the circumstances. Yet, I think our true and complete nature, as it says in the Zen tradition, is closer than the nose on your face. But we have to look. Here's a short dialogue with the Chinese Zen teacher Baijiang Huahai, who lived in China during the Tang Dynasty. Baijiang is one of my favorite Chinese ancestors. Lots of stories about him. So a monk asked Baijiang, "What is Buddha?" Right, kind of question you can come in and ask Kate next time in Doksan. What is Buddha? And Baijiang said, "What are you?" The monk said, "Me." Baijiang said, "Do you know me or not?" And this monk maybe had practiced a long time. He replied, "It's obvious." I think I would have whacked him at that point. Baijiang held up his whisk and said, "Do you see the whisk?" And the monk replied, "Yes." And then Baijiang said no more. What is Buddha? What are you? And Dogen echoes this same teaching for us in the Fukan Zazengi, another chant that we do, particularly in longer retreats. And the line goes like this: "Why leave behind the seat that exists in your own home and go aimlessly off to the dusty realms of other lands?" Right? Your own seat right here, your own heart. Look there, Dogen tells us. So the next lines in the Song of Zazen refer to the young, like a child out of a wealthy home wandering poor among the poor refers to a parable. How many people here are familiar with the Lotus Sutra? Just not okay. Anyway, very famous Buddhist teaching or sutra in the Mahayana tradition. Extremely popular in East Asia, China, Korea, and Japan. And so let me give you the little story here. The story goes like this. There was a very wealthy man in India who had only one young son. And one day the young son wandered off or else was taken away. And although the father searched far and wide, the son remained lost. Years passed, but the father still yearned for his son, never forgetting him. And then one day, as the father was at home looking out a window, he saw a beggar at the door and immediately recognized the beggar as his long-lost son. He called out to his servants to bring the beggar to him, but the beggar grew afraid and refused to even enter the house. The father then realized his son, taken so long ago, no longer recognized the home and was afraid of maltreatment. And so the father devised a plan to gradually bring home his own son by first having a servant offer the young man odd jobs around the grounds. And then, jobs in the household. And finally, after a number of years, to work side by side with the father as a kind of chief accountant. And all this time, the young man was not told that he was the lost son. And then finally, as the father was soon to die, the young man, now strong in confidence, was told. And the father announced the truth to the whole household. What is Buddha? Bai Zhong asked. How would you answer that? Don't answer right now. What is Buddha? Metaphors and parables are really common teaching tools in the Buddhist tradition. And Hakuin also made very good use of these to help clarify various Zen teachings. So let's just read the next little verse. Lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. From dark path to dark path, when shall we be freed from birth and death? And birth and death here, of course we could take it as reincarnation, but I suspect Hakuin means, you know, birth and death that happens, that we experience, you know, throughout every day of our life, maybe even through every moment of our life. Something arises, something disappears, we try to hang on to it, we try to push it away if we don't like it. It's just, every day is like that, right? I think this is what he's talking about. So here, Hakuin reminds us of why we suffer, why we see only dimly, if at all, our true nature. We are lost on dark paths of ignorance. And Buddhist literature discusses the nature of this ignorance in great, great detail. The Buddhist tradition describes the causes of our blindness to our Buddha nature, to our true nature, describes them as greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons. And these fundamental poisons obscure our true self and in combination cause the endless varieties of suffering found in our body, our mind, our hearts, our speech. The Sanskrit word for these poisons is klesha, or kleshas, which means to cover or obscure. To cover or obscure. I think this is important for us to realize. There's not something for us to get. There's something for us to uncover. In our constant seeking of relief, we wander from dark path to dark path, seeking a lasting satisfaction, a place free from the afflictions of life. And these paths that we are lost on are not anyone else's fault. The ignorance that we have to be aware of is not someone else's ignorance. It's our own that we need to wake up to. Seeking a lasting satisfaction, seeking a place free from the afflictions of life. Haven't we all been trying this for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years? Good luck. Right. Doesn't work. There is no place free of life's afflictions. So we wander the six worlds or the six realms. And the concept of the six worlds or six realms is also known as the wheel of life in the Buddhist tradition. And the pictures, I'll try bringing one next week, are pretty common in Buddhist iconography, particularly in the Tibetan tradition. So according to the Buddhist cosmology, there are six realms that we can be born into. The God realm, the Asura or Titan realm, the human realm, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realm. And so, brief description. In the God realm, or sometimes known as the Deva realm, everything is perfect. This is what we think we want. The beings enjoy great power, wealth, and very long life. And they live in splendor and in happiness, kind of like a TV commercial. Like one of those beer ads, you know. Happy, happy, happy. And yet, even these gods or devas grow old and die. And the big problem, though, is that their privilege and unending pleasure blind them to the suffering of others, so that in spite of their long lives, they have neither wisdom nor compassion. They're just consumed with their own pleasure. So when their good karma runs out, comes to an end, they're reborn in one of the lower realms. It's temporary. So the next realm down, the Asura realm, has very strong and powerful beings marked by their fierce envy and greed for power. Right? Kind of like A-type personalities. The hungry ghost realm is filled with those looking outside for anything that will satisfy their particular craving that they have. And often in pictures, hungry ghosts are characterized by, of course, insatiable hunger and craving, and yet they have itty-bitty little mouths that can't swallow very much, and tiny little necks. It takes a long time to get whatever little bites they can nibble off down their long gullets. And then they have huge bellies. So they're constantly craving, but unable to be satisfied. Beings in the animal realm are marked by, and I think this is unfair, but stupidity, prejudice, and complacency. I think that's, animals should not be marked by this. So there, beings in the animal realm live sheltered lives, trying to avoid any discomfort or anything unfamiliar, focused only on their personal needs and wants. And the hell realm is one of great confusion and suffering, as you could imagine. So the realm that offers the most hope, of course, is the human realm. Because the human realm, according to the Buddhist tradition, has just enough suffering that we have incentive to seek awakening and to open our compassion, but not so much suffering that we're consumed by it and can't focus on our spiritual path. And contemporary teachers often talk about these six realms of states of mind, realms we can kind of be transported to in just a blink of an eye. Perhaps we win a game or a lottery, and we're in the heaven realm, right? Yay, I won Monopoly. Or we struggle with a coworker over the next promotion, right? Kind of Titan realm, struggle for power. Or we're caught in an addiction or lust endlessly after someone who shows no interest in us. Or perhaps we're numb to the conditions of others and live our own life within the narrow concerns of our own desires and needs. Or we're locked in a place of deep despair. All those are possible, right? In some variation or another, we can quickly move throughout the day from one to the other. When shall we be free of birth and death? When shall we be free of this painful, intricate net of causes and conditions? This question is, I think, one version of the deep question of our lives. Aware of our human condition, of the pain and dissatisfaction that we experience and cause, how do we respond? How do we find liberation from this condition? So I'm going to pause here, and we're going to spend a couple of minutes in groups like we usually do. And I'm going to ask you to do two things. One is just to briefly point out what stood out for you in the poem, what you underlined, and maybe why. And if you underlined a lot or marked a lot, just pick one or two things. You don't have to do the whole thing. And then the next thing, because we ended on this profound question of birth and death, our question of life, what is your deep question or motivation on this journey that you're on? If you can articulate it, what is your deep question? Maybe right now, what is your deep question? And if all this just flows off your tongue very quickly, you can maybe also add, has it changed from when you were younger, this question or questions? That sound okay? So we'll get into groups of three, and I think everyone here kind of knows the routine. I'll ring a bell, and then one person will speak, the other two people will just listen. I'll ring the bell again when the time is over, and then the next person will go. We don't ask questions or crosstalk, or meaning we don't refer to what someone else has said. And it just stays in this room. We don't bring it up when we are outside having tea and cookies, unless that person wants to bring it up in some way. Are we okay?